Investigating Dark Money Flowing Through Miami, Judge Barbara Lagoa, and Understanding the Term Latinx. Hello and welcome to Sundial. I'm Tim Padgett, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Thousands of leaked bank documents detail a massive network of international money laundering connected to some of the world's biggest banks. A number of the key players in that network are based in South Florida. Plus, Judge Barbara Lagoa is on President Trump's shortlist of nominees to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the U.S. Supreme Court.
I was born in Miami and I grew up in Hialeah.
We'll learn about her rise through Florida's judicial system, starting with the Aileen Gonzalez case. Finally, what does it mean to be Latinx? A panel conversation with an artist and a linguist. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett, filling in for Luis Hernandez. A sunny place for shady people. That's long been Miami's unofficial motto. An investigation into a trove of leaked banking documents sheds a whole new light on this expression. Over the past 16 months, 400 journalists around the world have been poring through thousands of financial documents originally leaked to BuzzFeed News. The documents detail an elaborate network of money laundering by corrupt political officials and organized crime syndicates using major financial institutions to conduct their business. Kevin G. Hall is chief economics correspondent and senior investigator at McClatchy Newspapers, and Antonio Maria Delgado is a staff writer at the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald. They've been examining the Miami connections to this money laundering network. Kevin, Antonio, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Kevin, we've long known that Miami is a hub for international money laundering going back decades. It was recently exposed through the Miami Herald's reporting on the Panama Papers back in 2016. What new information did the team of journalists gather from the FinCEN, or Financial Crime Enforcement Network, leak that gives us a greater scope or understanding of that problem?
Well, this is kind of the Panama Papers in reverse, having been one of the leads on that project. You know, there we had shell companies, and then we had to kind of from there try to build out where the money was. Here we had, here's the money. Now try to find out, you know, who all the players who are moving it are. So it's kind of the flip of it, but it confirmed in the same way that the Panama Papers confirmed the way in which money flowed through South Florida and the large volumes, you know, kind of the whack-a-mole nature of trying to combat this.
Right. And when we refer to the FinCEN, or the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, what exactly does this organization do?
It's part of the Treasury Department, and it is kind of more like a clearinghouse or a repository. The Bank Secrecy Act requires banks and other financial institutions to report what they consider suspicious activity or things that could be signs of money laundering, of structuring, of layering, of different ways of kind of trying to move money in smaller parcels to avoid reporting requirements, all these things, kind of hallmarks,
right.
Comes into FinCEN, and then FinCEN, which has about 300 analysts, then works with IRS, State Department, and law enforcement, FBI, and others to figure out what to do.
And what was their response to the leaked documents and to your request for interviews? I mean, my impression was that they were not too happy about this.
No, and BuzzFeed has been the lead on that. So they and the ICIJ went to FinCEN, and they basically put out a statement in a way very much like Vladimir Putin did with the Panama Papers, trying to front run it, put out a statement, say, we understand that journalists are going to be writing a story about, and we've referred this to the Justice Department and to our Inspector General.
Right.
So days later, right before publication, then they had a call for comment on ways to improve the anti-money laundering system.
Antonio, many of the key players in Latin America connected to this global money laundering network are what we often call boliburgueses. That's a sort of a Spanish combination of two words, the Bolivarian Revolution, the socialist revolution in Venezuela, and the bourgeoisie, or in effect, it's essentially guys who got rich under the socialist revolution in Venezuela. Let's look at one, Martin Lustgarten. Who is he? And can you give us a little bit of an idea of who he is?
Yes, actually, some of these people got very, very rich.
Right, right.
And I know you've been watching some of these players for the longest time, just as long as I have. Martin Luther Garden was a financial expert, and he began in the late 80s, early 90s in Venezuela, mm-hmm. operating. He was doing foreign exchange transactions. He would get close to wealthy families and offer his services and being able to get dollars for them.
Right. And I should point out, Antonio, currency exchange is one of the biggest ways that people get filthy rich in Venezuela in rather underhanded ways, right?
Yes. Yes, they have. And actually, that happened, most of it happened under Chavez. Even though Venezuela had foreign exchange scandals, even back to the 80s.
But sure.
In the 90s, in the early Chavez years, when he basically forbid Venezuelans to own dollars. A lot of people were hungry for dollars, and the only people that had them were very connected businessmen linked to the regime who had access to it. And when Luis Cardin was operating, he was one of those people. He had access to those dollars and were able to offer them to legitimate companies seeking dollars mm-hmm. and families and so on. Mm-hmm. At some point, this became a money laundering tool because when people had to go to the, you had clean dollars, you would have to go to the black market, and you could use dirty dollars to buy bolivars and then use those bolivars to get back legitimate dollars from people like Luis Cardin. And some of this money was then later transferred from account from shell companies to shell companies. Mm-hmm. And in the end, you had clean money.
Right.
It is believed that he laundered hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars through this system.
Wow. And he also became connected to a Venezuelan TV mogul, to a Swiss banker, to drug cartels. What describe a little more specifically his role with, vis-a-vis people like that, his role in that network of money laundering?
Just because he became a big player in that system. Then you had kleptocrats, and we're talking about people like Raul Gorin, who owns Global Vision, use him to be able to move his money, ill-gotten gains around. And a lot of this we saw in the indictments against them and against Corinne and against some of the creepy players in the federal court in Miami.
Right.
He was a key player in that. But he was charged for laundering money for the drug cartels because the authorities detected that some of those transfers went to companies controlled by the cartels.
And how did he get on the U.S. government's radar?
At some point, he was involved in a scheme involving an executive at Bank of America, and initially he got in touch with those with the officials trying to negotiate a deal. At some point, he became allegedly an informant for the DEA, but the DEA kind of turned him down because they didn't find him credible.
Right.
And afterwards, he started cooperating with prosecutors,
right.
And spilling the beans on some of his former customers and his partners.
I'm speaking with Kevin G. Hall, senior investigator at McClatchy Newspapers, and Antonio Maria Delgado. He's a staff writer at the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald. You can find their reporting on the FinCEN files and the South Florida connections on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Kevin, let me ask you, is it common for those involved in money laundering schemes to cooperate with the federal government for their own protection? Or was Lustgarten or guys like Lustgarten, are their cases something of an anomaly?
Yeah, I think it's an anomaly. I don't think this is a normal course of events. I think, as Jay and Antonio both reported, it was kind of brought about by a mistake by the Boston DOJ, and they tried to go to trial quickly and then didn't have documents from Switzerland. And it was, they were forced to kind of drop charges, but they had him at least in a position where he was willing to turn lemons into lemonade and make it something that worked for both of them. So I don't think it's normal. One thing that was striking in their story was that Luis Cardin moved, the banks flagged him for over $400 million, which is about four times larger than what the public documents suggested.
Right. But Kevin, what are the difficulties that federal prosecutors face in bringing criminal charges against guys like this involved in these Baroque money laundering schemes?
Well, there's a number of difficulties, one of which is, do they charge? He was unusual because he actually was charged with money laundering. There's a statute for money laundering. More often than not, they go for lesser charges like wire fraud, things of that sort that are easier to establish, and you don't have as high bar of proving ill-gotten money that then flows through. So Loosgarten was unique also in that way, that they actually had him on money laundering charges, not wire fraud. Mm-hmm. But it's tough because you're relying on the Swiss, you're relying on shell companies, you're relying on all these places that are cogs in a system designed to make it difficult to go after the money.
As you described it before, whack-a-mole.
Yep.
Antonio, let's look at another important player out of Venezuela, another bully burgués here that you profiled, Alejandro Ceballos Jimenez. How did the Ceballos family accrue their fortune, and it is a ton of a fortune, in South Florida?
They've been working for years with the Venezuelan socialist regime. They got huge construction projects, including housing for the Mission Che Guevara, which was a housing project designed by Chavez for people of low-income Venezuelans, but they also had dealings with different government contracts. They were involved in the CVG in the mining state of Bolivar. They had projects there, and they also were involved in the renovation of the racetrack in Venezuela, La Rinconada, which was a very well-known racing spot. They've been working with the government for years, very closely to, they were very close to high-ranking government officials.
Right. And Antonio, I have to admit, one of the things that really stuck out for me in your reporting was the fact that, as I think you pointed out, that a lot of his activities had to do with the construction of things like public housing, things that are supposed to serve the people, regular people in Venezuela, but yet things like public housing have turned out to be the biggest source of embezzlement in Venezuela. People like Alex Saab, for example, who's another notorious money launderer coming out of Venezuela. These projects that are supposed to benefit the Venezuelan people are often the sources for these kinds of shenanigans. How much more suffering does that add to the lives of Venezuelans who are already under the worst economic crisis in the world today?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of drainage of public funds in some of these dealings that they would keep, businessmen connected to the government in partnership with key officials would keep $2 out of $3 given by the government. But the worst thing in my mind is that the regime for years kept a tight control of the foreign exchange, keeping a low exchange rate for official bolivars and forcing regular businessmen to pay the sometimes 10 times higher or even higher than that exchange rate, forcing them basically to be out of competition with foreign imported goods. So in a sense, you were killing the economy to be able to keep the system that allows them to embezzle the public funds.
Right.
So it's you were sacrificing the public, the people, to be able to participate in these corruption schemes.
Right. Well, that's one of the great tragedies of this. Kevin, President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence have suggested that targeting the Venezuelan government and rooting out corruption is a top foreign policy priority in Latin America. To what extent have prosecuting financial crimes been a part of that strategy? And do you think, really, has there been much success?
There's been some success, and it's a policy that started under the Obama administration and has continued, ramped up a little further by the Trump administration. But they've targeted people close to Nicolas Maduro and close to people key in the regime,
who many consider probably the most powerful man.
Until he himself
was infected with COVID-19 recently.
Yep, as we're told. Yes, I mean, I think they've tried to I think at this point, they don't think it's one person that rules Venezuela. It's several, and right. they've tried to get at that network. And there's been some success, but as these documents show, they find a way to work with the Swiss. They find a way to, you know, use Seychelles or BVI or wherever it may be to move money around. Oddly enough, Belize is a common place as well.
Right. And Antonio, let me end it here. You've been reporting on the corruption of the Bully Borghesis for years, and this is probably a naive question to ask if you're surprised anymore by anything, but are you surprised at all by the sophistication of these money laundering networks coming out of, particularly out of Venezuela, or the inability of prosecutors to really rein them in?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think they've gotten increasingly more sophisticated. They probably could teach, you know, classes on how to launder money.
Right.
The way they've been doing it for years, and now with the U.S. sanctions, and now with all the attention, international attention on them, they've gotten even more sophisticated. But they have huge fortunes in the international system. They were able to, you know, take out billions and billions of dollars, and some of these accounts. Some of this money eventually flow back to the U.S. market, and you might, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to find ill-gotten funds from the Venezuelan regime in Wall Street in big firms just because it's been siphoned out for years.
Right. I've been speaking with Kevin G. Hall, senior investigator at McClatchy Newspapers, and Antonio Maria Delgado, staff writer at the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald. Kevin and Antonio, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
Still to come, what does it mean to be Latinx? A panel discussion. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett, in for Luis Hernandez today. You may not have heard the term Latinx in conversation, but perhaps you've seen it on your social media feeds or in articles. Instead of using Latino or Latina, Latinx has emerged as a rejection of the gendered nature of the Spanish language. In Spanish, most words that end with an O are masculine, and most words that end with an A are feminine, much like other Romance languages. Latinx is considered by many, especially in the LGBTQ community, as a more inclusive identification. Joining us now is Naomi Guerrero. She recently was a curatorial fellow at the Perez Art Museum in Miami, focused on Latinx art. Now, she's an art history PhD student at the City University of New York. Also joining us is Dr. Philip Carter. He's an associate professor of English and linguistics at Florida International University. And by the way, find us at WLRN Sundial and let us know what you think of the term Latinx and whether you've adopted it. Naomi, Philip, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Philip, what is the origin of the word Latinx?
The origin of the word Latinx is a movement of people who are saying we want inclusivity for Latinx, Latino, Latina people, mostly in the United States and Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. But it's a part of a broader movement that's shaping languages around the world for gender inclusivity. As languages reckon with feminist movements and LGBTQ plus movements, languages are taking a look at their pronominal systems, at their words for the professions, which were often historically tied to particular sexes or genders. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, how do we remedy this? So Latinx is a part of that movement.
But is this term getting traction in the broader lexicon, Philip? I mean, a recent Pew survey of Latinx adults in the United States found only 3% of them use the term.
I mean, that's an interesting point, but no term, no word Okay, so how do words work? No word in the history of words is immediately adopted by every single language user at once.
Good point.
Words have to be diffused through the language.
Mm-hmm.
Latinx is definitely a new term, but the fact that, by the way, when we say only 3% of the people use it, 3% of Latinx people in the United States is still an awful lot of people. 3% of 60 million people is still quite a large number.
Yeah.
And secondly, it takes time for words to diffuse through the population. I mean, we did an event at FIU in the Center for Humanities in an Urban Environment on Monday night focusing on this term. And we had people log into the call, about 500 people, who said, oh, we'd never heard of this term before, but now we understand it. Now we understand what it means. So it is, its use is spreading.
Naomi, why do you think Latinx hasn't yet caught on with more of this community?
Well, I would maybe push back on the question and and think about the ways in which, again, as he had mentioned before, I'm so sorry that I can't remember your name, you just said it, but it is quite being used with a large number of people, and it's usually a minority, which is people that are not subscribing to the gender binary, and also people that are looking to be inclusive of, again, people that are going beyond the gender binary. It's also something that, if you think about the way you use words, you don't walk into a room and say, hi, I'm Latinx. Or
right.
all of, like, you don't, no one does that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think for me, it's useful in writing versus talking and saying it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you, even when you ask somebody, oh, do you use the word Latinx? The answer is probably no. It's a very new word. But in movement circles, it's very common.
Mm-hmm. Right. And by the way, the our other guest, his name's Philip. Philip Carter.
Okay. Naomi,
this survey also found that young women are the most likely to use the term. And that resonates with me because my half Venezuelan daughter was an organizer of her college's Hispanic Student Society, and they made a point of calling it Latinx Unidex instead of Latinos Unidos. Why are young Latinx women more drawn to this, do you think?
Well, obviously, because the Spanish language constantly reverts back to masculinity. If
right.
there are more than two people gathered, regardless if it's two women, men, whatever, regardless of the genders, it automatically reverts back to masculine. So I think it's a disruption. It's an invitation to disrupt a consciousness that we have as a lot of straight, heteronormative people. It requires for you to pause and think and, again, stretch your consciousness beyond what you, the way that you usually interact with other people.
Mm-hmm. Now, because,
and that's why it's uncomfortable. That's why it's uncomfortable, and that's why people resist it, because it's not comfortable and it's not easy.
Mm-hmm. Philip, because the Latinx term avoids the gender binary, it's also considered, I think, as you pointed out earlier, more inclusive by the LGBTQ community. Are they more likely to adopt the term as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that Latinx is a term that's being adopted by young women, as you said, but also LGBTQ plus people, but also young people in general, young Latinx people who may not identify as LGBTQ plus,
right.
but nevertheless see themselves as a part of a coalition of people. And so in the end, the term is it can be broadened to also think about the broadest possible coalitions of people to go under this term, inclusivity in terms of sexuality, gender, but also race and ethnicity. So people
yes.
who are drawn to that type of inclusivity are more likely to use it.
Right, and I wanted to ask you, Naomi, about that issue, racial inclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
What does the term Latinx do for Black Latinx persons such as yourself and also Indigenous Latin Americans?
Yeah, so for me, Latinx doesn't have a racial or ethnic sort of signifier. So in my own work, I'm always very specific in terms of, like, who am I talking to or about? And so I always specify Black Latinx, Indigenous Latinx, or whatever, because the Latinx category is meant to encompass of a huge, diverse array of races and ethnicities. I think what I found among Black Latinx people is that the people usually choose to put the Afro or the Black in front of it to
mm-hmm.
be very specific, because Latinx is usually marked as a non-Black category. It's often marked that way in the media and in popular culture. Mm-hmm.
Philip, the Pew survey notwithstanding, then, do you see the use of Latinx growing inside and outside the community, particularly because, as you pointed out, this is a phenomenon of the young, the younger sector of the Latinx community?
Well, I mean, it's a tricky question to answer because you can't predict what direction a language will change. Language always follows what people do. Language change, you know, has some independent components, but by and large, language moves in the direction of what people do. So really the question is, what are people going to do? Do we move increasingly in the direction of inclusivity, or do people see that that's something that's not desirable? And if the answer is yes, then the term will likely stick around or catch on or alternate. I mean, look at the alternation between Black American, and African American. I mean, African American has actually been around for a very, very long time, but finally kind of caught on in the 1980s when people like Jesse Jackson advocated for African American as an alternative to Black.
Right.
And it's not like it replaced Black. Both terms are in circulation and used by different people at different times. Mm-hmm. Another example would be MS, to replace the distinction between MISS and MRS, noting that it's unfair to mark the marital status of women but not mark the marital status of men.
Right.
And so now we have that title form MS in circulation. It didn't it didn't replace MISS and MRS, but they're all used together.
No, those are good examples. I'm speaking with Naomi Guerrero. She recently was a curatorial fellow at the Perez Art Museum in Miami, focused on Latinx art. And Philip Carter, Dr. Philip Carter, an associate professor of English and linguistics at FIU. We're talking about the term Latinx. Naomi, in your work within the art community, what impact and importance do these labels, such as Latinx, hold in that arena?
So I think within the visual art, right. Latinx provides, for me as a scholar, art historian, curator, it provides a useful framework, right? When I use Latinx, I'm specifically reconsidering artists of Latin American and Caribbean descent whose practice is informed by a lived United States experience, a lived U.S. experience. The term, for me as a scholar, encompasses a heterogeneous, diverse group of artists who often portray notions of multilingualism, exile, migration, nationality, cultural affiliation, and those themes are present in the artwork that they are sharing with the world. And for me, Latinx also provides a framework in order for me to do that and to also pretty much call out any institutions that are excluding that particular sensibility from their collections or their programming or what have you.
Right. Well, Naomi, I know you have to rush off now to teach a course, if I'm not mistaken. But we so much appreciate you being with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
That was Naomi Guerrero. She recently was a curatorial fellow at the Perez Art Museum in Miami, focused on Latinx art. And I should point out here, we heard from one of our listeners on Twitter, Raquel V. Reyes. She says, I'm an adult that uses it, meaning the term Latinx. I use Latinx to refer to a group and Latina to refer to myself. This kind of goes back to what you were saying, Philip, earlier about the variability and the, you know, how we're not sort of confining ourselves to just one term, that people may be using different terms in different contexts and different situations. Does this resonate with you as well?
Yeah, I think, I mean, she's exactly who we would want to hear from to make that point, that multiple terms can be in circulation. I mean, look, we don't have to settle on one term. People get to shuttle between the terms that they think best suit them. And, you know, another point Naomi was saying earlier, that people are uncomfortable. People are uncomfortable with this and other terms because words are also about power. Who has the ability to come up with a word? Who has the ability to advocate for the circulation of a word? Who has the ability to name themselves, to say what they want to be called? And so I think that is really really at what is at the heart of the controversy, and so far there's a controversy, is really who gets to come up with words? Who has the power to do that, and who has the power to name themselves? And so I love the Twitter user who says, yes, I use both. Right. I use both.
But one of the arguments against the word Latinx is that it doesn't exactly roll off the tongue for Spanish speakers, or English speakers for that matter, and that the X imposes sort of, you know, if you want to talk about the impositions of in our lexicon, that the X imposes a sort of English on Spanish speakers. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's not my place to say if people should feel offended by the presence of X in Spanish, but I will answer that question in a couple of ways. First, let's look at English. Is Latinx hard for English speakers to pronounce? This is one of those cases where people's ideological beliefs override their actual use of the language, mm-hmm. because we have all kinds of words in English phonology that end with the sound kss, tax being one of them. I mean, we could just go through and spend the rest of the day enumerating words that end in the sound KS,
right.
The Latinx. That's fine. There's no phonological rule against that in English.
Mm-hmm.
In Spanish, the sound kss exists. It is correct that it's in all kinds of words, like taxi, un taxi, excepcional. You know, there's all kinds of words that have kss. It's true that in Spanish, kss usually does not come at the end of a word. However, Spanish does have borrowings from English in which it comes at the end of the word. So mm-hmm. the borrowing un tax or mm-hmm. un impuesto, a tax.
Right.
And people don't really have trouble saying that. So my point is not necessarily to prove that people are wrong when they say that you can't pronounce it in Spanish, but rather to say that it's maybe less of a big deal than people make it out to.
Right. And I remember I was talking about this with my daughter last night, and she mentioned that an alternative, perhaps, approach that's often being discussed is putting A at the end, like Latine, mm-hmm. because, and also with the word, instead of saying A like he or ella for she in Spanish, you could say ele, and that would be the same sort of compromise. Does that ring true as well?
Yeah, and that's the way that in we're talking about, let's first clarify that we're talking about a term that is in circulation in a bilingual situation. The bilingual situation being the United States, where there are some 55, 60 million speakers of Spanish,
right.
most of whom, the vast majority of whom, are also English speakers. So
right.
this is a term that's mostly in circulation in a bilingual context.
Well, in monolingual
Spanish-speaking context,
mm-hmm.
In monolingual Spanish-speaking context, A is an alternative that's in circulation in places like in Spain and Argentina and elsewhere, where the
right.
same type of movement is saying we need to revise, we need to think through, we need to be inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And it really works with the so-called generic masculine forms, so
right.
forms that where the plural is assumed to be masculine as a default. So things like
mm-hmm.
todos, everyone,
right.
nosotros, we, amigos, niños, you know, all of those types of words, ciudadanos, citizens, that are
right.
considered masculine in their plural default form,
right.
assuming that there are also women involved in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so people have just simply revised and said, well, what if we say todes for todos,
right.
nosotres
mm-hmm.
for nosotros, and so forth.
Well, Philip, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. I mean, this is fascinating. We could talk. I could keep talking with you all day
yeah.
about this. Unfortunately, we have to leave it there for time. But again, thank you for being with us. This was Dr. Philip
thank
Carter,
you.
An associate professor of English and linguistics at FIU. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Still to come, a look at Judge Barbara Lagoa, who could be nominated to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the Supreme Court. President Trump is visiting Florida today. He will also be stopping in Jacksonville. But the president said yesterday he no longer plans to meet with Judge Barbara Lagoa as part of his Florida visit. But he said Lagoa is still on his short list of potential nominees to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the U.S. Supreme Court. Lagoa is a Cuban American who grew up in Miami. She first hit the public spotlight 20 years ago for her work in the Elian Gonzalez case, and then rose through Florida's judicial system to become a member of the state Supreme Court. Last December, she was appointed to the federal bench as a judge on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta. Joining us now is Professor David Abraham, professor of law emeritus at the University of Miami. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Judge Barbara Lagoa is certainly an inspiring Miami story. The daughter of Cuban exiles, raised in Hialeah, an FIU grad. Is that what makes her such an appealing Supreme Court choice for the Trump administration?
Well, she certainly is an ideal figure for the political moment where ethnicity and gender and representation have joined ideology in how a political person is marketed. We can see it on the Democratic side with Kamala Harris. We talk about her gender and her background more than about her beliefs. But Judge Lagoa does represent someone who combines the attractive personal story, the ethnicity, and the gender with some very hard rightist politics.
Right. But let's, speaking of that, let's look back 20 years ago when Justice Lagoa was a pro bono attorney in the case of Aileen Gonzalez. Remind us of her role in that effort to prevent the six-year-old boy's return to his father in Cuba and keep him here with relatives in Miami.
Yes. Well, Aileen's parents were divorced. They had a joint custody agreement. As we know, Aileen's mother, together with her subsequent boyfriend, who was a professional smuggler, attempted to come to the United States. The mother, alas, drowned. Aileen arrived here with his father in Cuba. According to all international child custody agreements from The Hague and elsewhere, as well as American family law, the surviving parent is entitled to resume custody. But that became an extremely hot issue in Miami, and due to Attorney General Janet Reno's extremely poor judgment in placing Aileen with his relatives here while the case was being adjudicated, it provided a foothold for the politicization of the family affair.
Right.
Barbara Lagoa entered that fray as a militant advocate of the family in Miami that won her a great deal of attention and respect. She did a very good work on the law. She had an extremely weak case, and they lost.
Right.
But it did earn her attention, which got her in 2006. Governor Bush's appointment to the district.
Like you, I watched the Aileen Gonzalez drama up close. And one of the things I still think about today is how it made Miami look like a place that puts Cuba politics above international law. What did we learn about Lagoa's approach to the law from that episode?
Well, I think we learned two things. One, that hardball and politics, as we've come to expect it today, in some ways was premiered we had a dress rehearsal for it here in Miami. And unfortunately, we saw it then in the vote counting in the election of November 2000. The intensity of sentiment on the part of Cuban Americans toward not only the Castros themselves, but to anyone that could be thought of as being in the least bit sympathetic, whether it was Bernie Sanders last year or Bill Clinton a generation ago, becomes the fulcrum for unification of the community around this issue and the disciplining of any dissent from it. It's not a good way to run a democratic political process.
But David, what does it tell us, though, about her personal approach to the law in terms of does it hint at any susceptibility to politics, to politicization, as you mentioned before?
Well, she has a very strong ideology, and she follows it. She's a very technically talented and skilled attorney and has a record of skilled opinion writing, all of which reflects an ideology that she is perfectly frank about and has no shyness about articulating. I don't think that should surprise anyone. What we have today, however, is a very overheated political judiciary.
From there, Lagoa steadily worked her way up in the court system, first as a United States District Attorney in South Florida. Then Governor Jeb Bush appointed her to Florida's Third District Court of Appeals. Like many prominent Cuban Americans here, was her relationship with the Bush family a, sort of a key to her ascent?
I think there's no question that the prominence today of Barbara Lagoa as a candidate is testimony not only to the Bush family's importance in Florida, but to the fact that at the end of the day, the DeSantis, Matt Gaetz, Bush, Trump thread is continuous, and whatever dissatisfaction there may be in certain Republican quarters with President Trump does not preclude their acting in concert for the things that they want, like a strongly conservative judiciary.
Right. Now, last year, Governor Ron DeSantis made her the first Hispanic woman to sit on the Florida Supreme Court. Here she is speaking from the Freedom Tower in Miami following her nomination.
I never imagined while I was attending FIU that I would be an appellate court judge at the court next door to that university. The Florida Supreme Court is tasked with the protection of the people's liberties under law. And in that regard, I am particularly mindful of the fact that under our constitutional system, it is for the legislature and not the courts to make the law. It is the role of judges to apply, not to alter, the work of the people's representatives.
Now, Lagoa was only on the Florida Supreme Court for about a year. She played an important role, though, in two high-profile cases, supporting the DeSantis administration in his removal of Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel following the Parkland shootings, and in oral arguments regarding Amendment 4, which restored felons' voting rights in Florida. She backed the law DeSantis and the state legislature pushed through that requires people who've had felony convictions to first pay fines and fees before they can vote. What was her argument in support of that law, David?
Well, let me get to that in a moment, but she was on the third DCA, a middling level court from 2006 to 2019, and then, as you point out, enjoyed an astronomically quick rise, first to the Florida Supreme Court and then to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. The clip that you just played, which I had not heard previously, is quite ironic in her commitment to the legislatures being the branch that makes the law, because while she was in the state appeals court, she reversed the decision of the Miami legislature to raise the minimum wage here in Miami. She reversed measures to make it more difficult to foreclose on homeowners and in distress. So it's quite ironic that, although it's consistent with conservative judicial arguments to talk about how judges only interpret the law and do not make the law, but in fact, she was very active in overturning laws that were not consistent with the conservative preference for business and property.
Right.
In the key referendum 4 that you mentioned, she was in the Florida Supreme Court along with one other judge when the state asked for an advisory opinion.
Right.
Offered the opinion that said, yes, the legislature may attach the requirement for the payment of fees and fines. And the case then moved into the federal court, which ruled the other way. Not once in the district court, but twice, also in the 11th Circuit.
Right, and some people say she should have recused herself because she had already proclaimed an opinion in the previous. I'm speaking with Professor David Abraham with the University of Miami School of Law. Justice Judge Barbara Lagoa is on President Trump's short list of potential nominees to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. The president is expected to make his announcement on Saturday. David, if Lagoa is nominated, she'll likely face scrutiny for her lack of experience as a federal judge. She's only been on the federal bench for less than a year now, and also for her relatively thin output of legal case opinions in general. Where would we expect her to land on some of the key cases that will face the Supreme Court in the coming years? Abortion, immigration, voting rights?
Well, I think there's no question that on the abortion issue, she is steadfastly with the other potential nominees in reducing Roe v. Wade to a meaningless minimum. More of greater concern, and one sees this from Attorney General Barr, is the growth of executive power and the notion that the power of the so-called unitary executive is central. I would see cases come up to overturn precedents like Morrison v. Olson and others that have limited the areas of executive independence. I think here we see a convergence between Pompeo, the Secretary of State, William Barr, the Attorney General, and this next Supreme Court justice around strong executive powers, strong property rights, a greater role for religion in public life, right, and a turn away from minority protections.
Right. Now, one of the points a lot of the pundits are making that Lagoa, because, as we've just been discussing, this lack of experience on her part, because they're suggesting that Lagoa is really more sort of a political asset nomination for President Trump because of the Florida cachet that she would bring if he were to nominate her. Another person on President Trump's shortlist is getting a lot of attention, and she seems to be the choice that people think will be made, Judge Amy Comey Barrett. Right. What does she bring to the table that differs from Lagoa?
Well, they have very strong and very similar views, in fact. There's a general agreement that Biden can win the presidency without Florida, but it's virtually impossible for Trump to win the presidency without Florida. And that's the essential difference between Lagoa and Barrett. Barrett sits in Chicago. She's from Indiana, but Mike Pence has got Indiana covered, and Illinois is out of Trump's reach. So the question is Florida more important? That it's consolidating, in particular the Hispanic vote in Florida, more important than the additional experience and age that Amy Comey Barrett would bring. And that's a toss-up. Mm-hmm. Both of them have been thoroughly vetted and approved by the Federalist Society, which is the litmus test organization for conservative legal thinkers.
Right, right. Well, as I said, we'll wait for Saturday. I've been speaking with Professor David Abraham with the University of Miami School of Law. Justice Barbara Lagoa is on President Trump's shortlist of potential nominees to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. Professor Abraham, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And that's Sundial for Thursday, September 24th. Coming up next week on the program, colleges and universities across Florida are continuing to struggle with slowing the spread of the coronavirus on campuses. Are stringent enough measures being taken, or could leadership in higher education be doing more? We hear from the chancellor of Florida's college system about actions taken against COVID-19 and workforce training initiatives. Plus, temporary protected status for thousands of Salvadorans in the United States was put in jeopardy following a recent ruling by a federal court. We'll speak with a professor at FIU about what options are in place for families in South Florida and what it could mean for Central America if there's a forced migration from the U.S. Finally, if you've gone swimming along Palm Beach County's coast recently, you may have noticed manta rays. Dozens of them have been documented over the past couple of years, and they're a much younger population. Biologist Jessica Pate recently shared her story in National Geographic. We spoke with her. I'm Tim Padgett. Thank you so much for listening. Luis Hernandez will be back on Monday.